So I'm going to start, I guess, framing with some very large issues around global challenges, restructuring at times of turbulence, and both the challenges and opportunities there are in trying to achieve security and sustainability in a fundamentally unstable time. So, you know, we have sort of kind of 2 days that changed the world over a decade. I think it both began and ended with the collapse of two dominant ideologies. Right? And most recently, that's Alan Greenspan, who was an acolyte of Ayn Rand and finally declared free market ideology dead. As sort of the leading proponent of it, finally says he didn't know what happened as the world around him collapsed. And, excuse me. So, what we have to do, I think, in this kind of context is how do we reconcile organizational structures that best respond to global competition, you know, high degrees of change, flexibility, movement around the world, with considerations of work that best support workforce health, and in this time probably poses the greatest human resources challenge, which is just that of trying to achieve the kind of stability and social benefits that provide people the atmosphere and base for a healthy workplace and the kind of stability that people need in their lives in that period of profound change all around them and collapse. So what's happened over this past decade is what we call kind of the emergence of third-generation globalization, which is fundamentally new patterns of globalization by firms and how that has changed realignment with countries and companies and changes in corporate structure. So that's been sort of the detail of a lot of the work we've been doing, and I won't go into too much depth, but give an overview of that and then come back to what that means for creating healthy workplaces. So not too much detail. But if we look at what the change has been in corporate strategy from call the old globalization patterns to new globalization patterns, you see there's a change in moving around the world, sort of in strategic objectives, for kind of dominant markets, industrialized countries, where the expansion into the rest of the world is just looking for low-cost production, cheap labor markets, and shutting off older technology. So a strong division, sort of in north-south, first world, old world, developing world, third world, between where you locate your activities, where your dominant markets are, and where your labor is. Well, with globalization over the last 10 years and a great diffusion of these activities, you see new kinds of corporate strategies changing. And that is to look at local technology in places that had not been thought of as technology leaders before, looking not just for low-cost labor, but for innovation and talent in all corners of the world, particularly a number of the emerging developing countries, and then spreading global production. So it's not just low-end production, but high-end production. Around 2000, if you looked for the latest auto plants with the latest technology, it wasn't in Detroit, it wasn't in Stuttgart, Wolfsburg, it was in Mexico and Brazil. So it was a very fundamental change in production strategy where you started to be able to locate very high-end production around the world, regardless of whether it was an advanced industrial country or not. And as we often see now, the search for talent occurs not in just Boston, Silicon Valley, Bonn, but in Bangalore, Beijing, the things that we've all often heard about. And so this has created a very fundamental change in how we see the world and what the role of different countries are, and in terms of corporate strategy. It's also meant for emerging countries, emerging newly industrializing countries, a change in their strategies as well, of their place in the world and what they're looking for. So we see, for example, in kind of the old model of globalization, what firms tried to do was build their own indigenous industry, kind of to retain capital, to stop capital profit export. It was low-skilled jobs, looking for mass manufacturing and protectionism in markets. Now, what we see are these companies moving to the top of the value chain. So, which, again, you know, the obvious examples of China and India are competing at the top, that they're not going for low-end production, but trying to compete head-to-head with top-end production, produce innovation. So, in recent months, it's been recognized China is now the leading producer and perhaps innovator in alternative energy, bringing global development, global technology in a place that we never thought we would see it before. So it's finally upending what we think of as the arrangement both of company strategy and countries. And that's led to, again, a change we kind of call in the world order of how technology is organized, collaborators, and what the markets are. And if the old order looks something like this, kind of a dominant hierarchy where you saw the triad countries of Europe, U.S., Japan, with their various spheres of influence, each with its dominant companies and country kind of alliance, and then the Soviet bloc, countries sort of out of that sphere, where a GM and a Toyota were synonymous with a U.S. and Japanese sort of dominant bloc when you thought about alignment of company-country interests and what competition looked like. When that order has changed in the sphere of new globalization, we call this our third-generation globalization, it looks more like a network, kind of a strong node network, where you have networks emerge where there are dominant networks still of the what used to be the dominant blocks, the U.S., kind of Europe here shown, with their alliances to other countries, particularly in the emerging world, but also you see new networks start to emerge. So China moves out of the U.S. sphere and starts to develop its own linkages and sphere of influence, particularly in Africa, moving to areas that most of the rest of the world wrote off in terms of industrial development. And we see it now there with oil, mineral extraction, and developing its own spheres of influence, and a realignment. What it means in terms of national technology and competitiveness strategy is there is no dominance. It's more of a pluralistic globalization. And this is very different from the sort of flat earth society believers of kind of level playing fields, and rather calls to mind more a sense of shifting alliances, that it's less issues of head-on competition as though on a soccer field, and more of how do you be the best collaborator, how do you change alliances to bring countries to cooperate and move into your sphere as opposed to dominating a type of technology. And it's more complicated, but this is sort of a working schematic we can use for now. So with this comes a certain kind of decoupling then of a number of long-standing arrangements. And the outcome then is first these global networks, a realignment of who is in what sphere and how different countries and companies work together or compete, that is no longer defined by the same national boundaries, geographies, and kinds of divisions of the value chain innovation technology that once occurred. Particularly notable is the company and country decoupling. There's an expression Charlie Wilson from General Motors famously declared in the 50s, what's good for General Motors is good for the U.S. So there was to whatever extent it may or may not have been true, it represented a fundamental truth that you could look at the fortunes of a country's dominant industrial players, and they were closely linked to the industrial fortunes of that country. So it was good for General Motors, jobs, innovation, technology. Today, that is far from clear. It's unclear whether an investment by the U.S. in General Motors produces more jobs and returns to the U.S. than perhaps it would be to Toyota, or even now some of the Korean car industries located in the U.S. That those alliances have become decoupled, and the negative because of changing fortunes of of companies, of national companies, but also given changes in company strategy. So the investment of a particular company in one geography is not as closely linked as it once was. That they're much more mobile. If we're going to go innovation, it could be as well as Bangalore as it could be in Silicon Valley. And there's certainly still some preferences, but that is changing. So it means for investment for a country that investing in what used to be national companies no longer provides the returns that it once did. There's no assurance that investment or development in technology in General Motors or IBM is going to stay within whatever national boundaries that provide that investment or development, but rather through company networks that are now globally diffuse, high-end technology will flow to China, India, Brazil, wherever those companies are located, because it is, after all, companies and not countries that are developing innovation and technology. So the geographic boundaries have dissolved, and therefore, from a national perspective, public investments do not return in the same way that they once did because of that decoupling. Similarly, for innovation and the returns there, that it was often talked about an innovation hierarchy among nations, once north-south, for, you know, first, second, and third world countries, and one could be assured that high-end innovation, top of the value chain activity, would occur in the advanced industrial countries, and that it would be lower-end jobs. So as a work strategy, it was often thought of there was some comfort in you move up the value chain, that the response to old patterns of globalization were to increase the skills value added in your workforce and keep ahead then of the low-end technology that was being shedded off to developing countries. So, latest automobile technology would be done in the advanced industrial worlds, and old model technology would be shunted off to developing countries. I said that's no longer true. You know, state-of-the-art auto plants are there, other kinds of technology development. So even the innovation, geographical stickiness and geographical definition of where innovation will occur is no longer coupled with sort of the industrial state or national boundaries. And part of this has had then some significant implications for what the income and economic returns are to an economy. Apart from the current collapse, we saw even during the high growth period, were different kind of economic returns, increasing inequality. And something that was probably not possible before is that you could have extreme inequality and difference in economic returns and high growth in a country. I mean, going famously back to Henry Ford, when he increased the wages, he said he needed to develop a middle-class economy to buy the products. Well, it's not clear that that's as necessary. When you have a Beijing market, it's not as clear that you need as much purchasing power in the U.S., for example. So the long-term support of different kinds of economic returns, different kind of income distribution, may not be as tightly coupled or geographically bounded as they once were. And part of this is, of course, with global labor markets, global labor arbitrage. And what still needs to be sorted out is competitiveness on labor rates. If you can no longer hold your labor market based on a capture on the top of the value chain, having the innovation center being a Silicon Valley that is somehow unique, and you're competing at that rate around the world, the kind of specialness in economic returns are not going to be as great. So what does that mean kind of at the micro level then? Back to healthy workplaces in the detail of moving quickly through that, is that at a micro level, we see a decoupling of social benefits. So in the U.S. and particularly, it's decoupling some of these benefits from firms. We've often in the U.S. put health benefits in particular tied to employment as in many other social benefits. Europe, those things have been generally tied to the state, and the influence from globalization has also decoupled some of that. We've seen a retrenchment, decoupling of social benefits in the European sense, not significant or not as great, but certainly in response to U.S. firms moving in there and questioning some of the relationships and provision of benefits, as well as European firms moving elsewhere in the United States, North America, and seen other alternatives. So that kind of decoupling has happened. The U.S. context is in the middle of a very active discussion about what that decoupling means and what the implications are. So at the moment, we're talking about moving health from the firm to perhaps the state, as in government provision of health care, or at least some kind of government involvement, of decoupling it from employment. And we've seen, the previous regime, that 16% of the U.S. population was uninsured because they didn't have access to health care through employer-provided health care. Employer-provided health care has been in decline. And competitively, a number of firms see this as a way to be globally competitive. Most notably, auto plants talk about the cost of health care embedded in each car and how that makes them globally competitive. So they're both opportunities and challenges from this kind of decoupling. So automobile companies in the U.S., for example, could see this as a benefit to move health care costs off the ledger, out of a private cost and embedded in their product to make them more competitive, whereas other companies see this obviously as a challenge. One of the more interesting, I think, and dynamic outcomes of this is a change we call job lock. That in the U.S., they talk about people who are stuck in a job because of social benefits, locked into the job that would otherwise move. Estimated a quarter, which I think rather astounding if it's correct, a quarter of the workforce say that they would voluntarily move their job if it were not tied to health and other kinds of retirement benefits. That is, that by decoupling social benefits, they would be more labor mobility. It's both, again, the challenge and the opportunity. It's the opportunity for more labor mobility, perhaps better matching in the labor market, but of course, a challenge. If you can ask any of our HR people what a 25% voluntary turnover would mean for the company and recruiting strategies. So this kind of decoupling at the micro level and changing social benefits, on the one hand, provides a great deal of fluidity, flexibility, and adaptation to a larger set of social changes, both opportunity and challenges. So to sum up, what we see then is, I think, an idea that there's a core employment stability that is needed, even in a period of instability and change. And structurally, this move from hierarchy to network and this decoupling of value chain, of comparative advantage, that there's decreasing national advantage or position to being located in an innovation or economic position that once held at the top of the value chain. Those kinds of relationships are dissolving, and insofar as it was linked to certain national companies, those are obviously dissolving as well. Global labor arbitrage provides a tremendous number of challenges as well as opportunities, but particularly for how do you provide the returns to a high-cost labor force, in the sense of globally high cost, that provides a number of social benefits, material wealth, in a global labor market. And particularly since so much of the firm competitive country strategy has been decoupled. The other two I'll just mention briefly are the traditional notions of geographical stickiness of innovation hotspots. The thought that there's something unique about a Silicon Valley Route 128 in the States that provided innovation advantages that could not be duplicated around the world. And for the past 10, 20 years, there's been a comfort that for whatever other changes there are, the Silicon Valley has a purchase on a piece of the technological world that cannot be duplicated elsewhere. These areas that organically rise and have some innovation advantages. That seems to be less true, that the geographic stickiness and hold on innovation is not that we're seeing, China arise with innovation in alternative energy, which is clearly globally important for the future. Technology, new technologies as well. So the geographic stickiness is a question that needs to be raised. The other is that we've assumed that human capital has been highly mobile, that you could set up shop anywhere and attract human capital to wherever you were. There's a great debate going on in the States now about U.S. universities attracting people from around the world, and now we see, while geographic stickiness of innovation seems to be declining, what is increasing is the geographic stickiness of human capital. Place and home are important for people generally, and particularly so, I would maintain, for more traditional communities. And we see a return to home country, a wanting to be place and family, that with more opportunity is kind of a pull factor, changing the nature of where capital location occurs. Even places like Bangalore, firms are talking about having to now move out to the villages to try and develop technological capabilities. And with all the other kind of technology that is occurring, this is much more possible. So a shift in the stickiness of human capital raises new questions. So with that, I want to end on our the question we'd pose from this quick tour of globalization, restructuring of the world order, in 15 minutes or less, with a question about what the implications are. Oops, I'm sorry, one other thing before that, is I think what that raises, going back to our Alan Greenspan declaration that the world as he knew it is over, the world order is over, is it provides the opportunity for alternative social and corporate frameworks. That in the midst of all this crisis, I think we are seeing the end of kind of a hegemonic U.S. market model, whether it's the dominance that we thought was going to be unstoppable of free market ideology, you know, when the leading acolyte of that declares it's over, we must take heed of that and say, what happens in that vacuum that's been created when its most fervent believers have said it's over? And it provides a space for alternatives, a rethinking. You know, rarely will we return to what was before, but something new will emerge. And in this space of considering the collapse of the old are the opportunities, and here is the real opportunity, for saying what are alternative social and corporate frameworks that can emerge out of this very dynamic change. And that is, I think, yet to be decided, but it is open territory for there. And so with that, I will now finally lead to my final question about balancing stability and change. And it is, how do you provide social and employment stability in inherently unstable conditions? So in the dynamism that is going to continue, when all of the former order has been upended and no sign of things going to the old, how can you at a micro level provide the benefits, the kind of security that people need, even if you're going to have high labor market turnover and fluidity? People need to be assured of the benefits, social benefits, and also the opportunities that they will continue to be employable, earn a living, even if it's detached to a lifelong career with a firm. And that is a question I think we have not well answered or provided the mechanisms for addressing. And I'm going to leave you with that question now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Harold, for that thoughtful framing.